Alien by Alan Dean Foster, F-O-S-T-E-R. Published by Warner Books Incorporated. And copyright by the 20th Century Fox Film Corporation. Read by Harold Roberts for the Library Services Branch of the Government of the Province of British Columbia, Vancouver, 1984. Chapter 1. Seven Dreamers. You must understand that they were not professional dreamers. Professional dreamers are highly paid, respected, much sought after talents. Like the majority of us, these seven dreamt without effort or discipline. Dreaming professionally, so that one's dreams can be recorded and played back for the entertainment of others, is a much more demanding proposition. It requires the ability to regulate semi-conscious creative impulses and to stratify imagination, an extraordinarily difficult combination to achieve. A professional dreamer is simultaneously the most organized of all artists and the most spontaneous. A subtle weaver of speculation, not straightforward and clumsy like you or I, or these certain seven sleepers. Of them all, Ripley came closest to possessing that special potential. She had a little ingrained dream talent and more flexibility of imagination than her companions, but she lacked real inspiration and the powerful maturity of thought characteristic of the pro-dreamer. She was very good at organizing stores and cargo, at pigeonholing carton A in storage chamber B, or matching up manifests. It was in the warehouse of the mind that her filing system went awry. Hopes and fears, speculations and half-creations slipped haphazardly from compartment to compartment. Warrant Officer Ripley needed more self-control. The raw, rococo thoughts lay waiting to be tapped just below the surface of realization. A little more effort, a greater intensity of self-recognition, and she would have made a pretty good pro-dreamer, or so she occasionally thought. Captain Dallas, now, he appeared lazy while being the best organized of all. Nor was he lacking in imagination. His beard was proof of that. Nobody took a beard into the freezers, nobody except Dallas. It was part of his personality, he'd explained to more than one curious shipmate. He'd no more part with the antique facial fuzz than he would with any other part of his anatomy. Captain of the two ships Dallas was the interstellar tug Nostromo, and his body. Both would remain intact in dreaming as well as when awake. So he had the regulatory capability and a modicum of imagination. But a professional dreamer requires a deal more than a modicum of the last, and that's a deficiency that can't be compensated for by a disproportionate quantity of the first. Dallas was no more realistic pro-dreamer material than Ripley. Kane was less controlled in thought and action than was Dallas, and possessed far less imagination. He was a good executive officer. Never would he be a captain. That requires a certain drive coupled with the ability to command others, neither of which Kane had been blessed with. His dreams were translucent, formless shadows compared to those of Dallas, just as Kane was a thinner, less vibrant echo of the captain. That did not make him less likable, but pro-dreaming requires a certain extra energy, and Kane had barely enough for day-to-day living. Parker's dreams were not offensive, but they were less pastoral than Kane's. There was little imagination in them at all. They were too specialized and dealt only rarely with human things. One could expect nothing else from a ship's engineer. Direct they were, and occasionally ugly. In wakefulness, this deeply buried awful rarely showed itself when the engineer became irritated or angry. Most of the ooze and contempt fermenting at the bottom of his soul's cistern were kept well hidden. His shipmates never saw beyond the distilled Parker floating on top, never had a glimpse of what was bubbling and brewing deep inside. Lambert was more the inspiration of dreamers than dreamer herself. In hypersleep, her restless musings were filled with inter-system plottings and load factors, canceled out by fuel considerations. Occasionally, imagination entered into such dream structures, but never in a fashion fit to stir the blood of others. Parker and Brett often imagined their own systems interplotting with hers. They consider the question of load factors and spatial juxtapositions in a manner that would have infuriated Lambert had she been aware of them. Such unauthorized musings they kept to themselves, securely locked in daydreams and nightdreams, lest they make her mad. It would not do to upset Lambert. As the Nostromo's navigator, she was the one primarily responsible for seeing them safely home, and that was the most exciting and desirable co-joining any man could imagine. Brett was only listed as an engineering technician. That was a fancy way of saying he was just as smart and knowledgeable as Parker, but lacked seniority. The two men formed an odd pair, unequal and utterly different to outsiders, yet they coexisted and functioned together smoothly. In large part, their success as both friends and co-workers was due to Brett never intruding on Parker's mental ground. The tech was as solemn and phlegmatic in outlook and speech as Parker was voluble and volatile. Parker could rant for hours over the failure of a microchip circuit damning its ancestry back to the soil from which its rare earth constituents were first mined. Brett would patiently comment, "Right." For Brett, that single word was much more than a mere statement of opinion. It was an affirmation of self. For him, silence was the cleanest form of communication. In loquaciousness lay insanity. And there was Ash. Ash was the science officer, but that wasn't what made his dreams so funny. Funny peculiar, not funny ha-ha. His dreams were the most professionally organized of all the crews. Of them all, he came nearest to matching his awakened self. Ash's dreams held absolutely no delusions. That wasn't surprising if he really knew Ash. None of his six crewmates did, though. Ash knew himself well. If asked, he could have told you why he could never become a pro-dreamer. None ever thought to ask, despite the fact that science officer clearly found pro-dreaming more fascinating than any of them. Oh, and there was the cat. Name of Jones, a very ordinary house cat, or, in this instance, ship cat. Jones was a large yellow tom of uncertain parentage and independent mien, long accustomed to the vagaries of ship travel and the idiosyncrasies of humans who travel through space. It too slept the cold sleep, and dreamt simple dreams of warm, dark places and gravity-bound mice. Of all the dreamers on board, he was the only contented one, though he could not be called an innocent. It was a shame none of them were qualified as pro-dreamers, since each one had more time to dream in the course of their work than any dozen professionals, despite the slowing of their dream pace by the cold sleep. Necessity made dreaming their principal avocation. A deep space crew can't do anything in the freezers but sleep and dream. They might remain forever amateurs, but they had long ago become very competent ones. Seven of them there were, seven quiet dreamers in search of a nightmare. While it possessed a consciousness of sort, the Nostromo did not dream. It did not need to anyone any more than it needed the preserving effect of the freezers. If it did dream, such musings must have been brief and fleeting, since it never slept. It worked and maintained, and made certain its hibernating human complement stayed always a step ahead of ever-ready death, which followed the cold sleep like a vast gray shark behind a ship at sea. Evidence of the Nostromo's unceasing mechanical vigilance was everywhere in the quiet ship, in soft hums and lights that formed the breath of instrumental sentience. It permeated the very fabric of the vessel, extended sensors to check every circuit and strut. It had sensors outside, too, monitoring the pulse of the cosmos. Those sensors had fastened onto an electromagnetic anomaly. One portion of the Nostromo's brain was particularly adept at distilling sense out of anomalies. It had thoroughly chewed this one up, found the flavor puzzling, examined the results of analysis, and reached a decision. Slumbering instrumentalities were activated. Dormant circuits again regulated the flow of the electrons. In celebration of this decision, banks of brilliant lights winked on, life signs of stirring mechanical breath. A distinctive beeping sounded, though as yet there were only artificial tympaniums present to hear and acknowledge. It was a sound not heard on the Nostromo for some time, and it signified an infrequent happening. With this awakening bottle of clicks and flashes of devices conversing with each other lay a special room. Within this room of white metal lay seven cocoons of snow-colored metal and plastic. A new noise filled this chamber, an explosive exhalation that filled it with freshly scrubbed, breathable atmosphere. Mankind had willingly placed himself in this position, trusting in little tin gods like the Nostromo to provide him with the breath of life when he could not do so for himself. Extensions of that half-sentient electronic being now tested the newly exuded air and pronounced it satisfactory for sustaining life in puny organics such as men. Additional lights flared, more linkages closed, Without fanfare, the lids on the seven chrysalises opened, and the caterpillar shapes within began to emerge once more into light. Seen shorn of their dreams, the seven members of the Nostromo's crew were even less impressive than they'd been in hypersleep. For one thing, they were dripping wet from the preservative cryo-sleep fluid that had filled and surrounded their bodies. However analeptic, slime of any sort is not becoming. For another, they were naked, and the liquid was a poor substitute for the slimming and shaping effects of the artificial skins called clothes. "Jesus!" muttered Lambert, disgustedly wiping fluid from her shoulders and sides. "Am I cold?" She stepped out of the coffin that preserved life instead of death, began fumbling in a nearby compartment. Using the towel she found there, she commenced wiping the transparent syrup from her legs. Why in the hell can't Mother warm the ship before breaking us out of storage? She was working on her feet now, trying to remember where she'd dumped her clothes. You know why? Parker was too busy with his own sticky, tired self to bother staring at the nude navigator. Company policy. Energy conservation, which translates as company cheap. Why waste excess power warming the freezer section until the last possible second? Besides, it's always cold coming out of hypersleep. You know what the freezer takes your internal temperature down to? Yeah, I know, but it's still cold. She mumbled it, knowing Parker was perfectly correct, but resenting having to admit it. She never cared much for the engineer. Damn it, Mother, she thought, seeing that the goosebumps on her forearm. Let's have some heat. Dallas was toweling himself off, dry sponging away the last of the cryosleep gunk, and trying not to stare at something the others could not see. He'd noticed it even before rising from his freezer. The ship had arranged it so that he would. "Work'll warm us all up fast enough," Lambert muttered something unintelligible. "Everybody to your stations. I assume you all remember what you're getting paid for, besides sleeping away your troubles." No one smiled or bothered to comment. Parker glanced across to where his partner was sitting up in his freezer. "Morning. You still with us, Brett?" "Yeah, lucky us." That came from Ripley. She stretched, turning it into a more aesthetic movement than any of the others. "Nice to know our prime conversationalist is as garrulous as ever." Brett just smiled, said nothing. He was as verbal as the machines he serviced, which was to say, not at all. And it was a running joke with the Subtule Crew family. They were laughing with him at such times, not at him. Dallas was doing side twists, elbows parallel to the floor, hands together in front of his sternum. He fancied he could hear his long, unused muscles squeak. The flashing yellow light, eloquent as any voice, monopolized his thoughts. That devilish little sun-hued cyclops was the ship's way of telling them they'd been awakened for something other than the end of their journey. He was already wondering why. Ash sat up, looked around expressionlessly. For all the animation in his face, he might as well still have been hyper-asleep. "I feel dead." He was watching Kane. The executive officer was yawning, still not fully awake. It was Ash's professional opinion that the exec actually enjoyed hypersleep and would spend his whole life as a narcoleptic, if so permitted. Unaware of the science officer's opinion, Parker glanced over at him, spoke pleasantly. "You look dead." He was aware that his own features probably looked no better. Hypersleep tried the skin as well as the muscles. His attention turned to Kane's coffin. The exec was finally sitting up. "Nice to be back," he blinked. "Couldn't tell it to any one of us, not by the time it takes you to wake up." Kane looked hurt. "That's a damn slander, Parker. I'm just slower than the rest of you, that's all." "Yeah." The engineer didn't press the point. Turned to the captain, who was absorbed in studying something out of the engineer's view. "Before we dock, maybe we'd better go over the bonus situation again." Brett showed faint signs of enthusiasm, his first since awakening. "Yeah." Parker continued, slipping on his boots. "Brett and I think we deserve a full share, full bonus for successful completion, plus salary and interest." Least he knew, deep sleep hadn't harmed his engineering staff, Dallas mused tiredly. Barely conscious for a couple of minutes, they were complaining already. "You two will get what you contracted for. No more, no less, just like everybody else." "Everybody gets more than us," said Brett softly. For him, that constituted a major speech. It had no effect on the captain, however. Dallas had no time now for trivialities or half-serious wordplay. That blinking light commanded his full attention and choreographed his thoughts to the exclusion of all else. "Everybody else deserves more than you two. Complain to the company disperser if you want. Now, get below. Complain to the company? Parker was muttering unhappily as he watched Brett swing out of his coffin, commence drying his legs. Might as well try complaining directly to God. Same thing. Brett was checking a weak service light on his own freezer compartment. Barely conscious, naked, and dripping with liquid, he was already hard at work. He was the sort of person who could walk for days in a broken leg, but was unable to ignore a malfunctioning toilet. Dallas started for the central computer room, called back over his shoulder, "One of you jokers, get the cat." It was Ripley who lifted a limp, yellowish form from one of the freezers. She wore a hurt expression. "You needn't be so indifferent about it." She stroked the soaked animal affectionately. "It's not a piece of equipment. Jones is a member of the crew as much as any of us." "More than some." Dallas was watching Parker and Brett, fully dressed now, receding in the direction of engineering. "Doesn't fill my few onboard waking hours with complaints about salary or bonuses." Ripley departed, the cat enveloped in a thick, dry towel. Jones was purring unsteadily, licking himself with great dignity. It was not his first time out of the hypersleep. For the present, he would tolerate the ignominy of being carried. Dallas had finished drying himself. Now, he touched a button set into the base in his coffin. A drawer slid silently outward on nearby frictionless bearings. It contained his clothing and a few personal effects. As he was dressing, Ash ambled over to stand nearby. The science officer kept his voice low, spoke as he finished seaming his clean shirt. "Mother wants to talk to you." As he whispered, he nodded in the direction of the yellow light flashing steadily on the suspended console nearby. "I saw it right off." Dallas slipped arms into his shirt. "Hard yellow? Security one? Not warning?" "Don't tell the others. If anything's seriously wrong, they'll find out soon enough." He slipped into an unpressed brown jacket, left it hanging open. "Can't be too bad, whatever it is." Ash sounded hopeful, gestured again at the steadily winking light. "It's only yellow, not red. For the moment." Dallas was no optimist. "I'd have preferred waking up to a nice forestry green." He shrugged, tried to sound as hopeful as Ash. "Maybe the auto chef's on the blink. That might be a blessing, considering what it calls food." He attempted a smile, failed. The Nostromo was not human. It did not play practical jokes on its crew, and it would not have wakened them from hypersleep with a yellow warning light without a perfectly good reason. The malfunctioning auto chef did not qualify as a candidate for the latter. Oh, well, after several months of doing nothing but sleeping, he had no right to complain if a few hours' honest sweat was now required of him. The central computer room was a little different from the other awake rooms aboard the Nostromo. A disarming kaleidoscope of lights and screens, readouts and gauges, it conveyed the impression of a wild party inhabited by a dozen drunken Christmas trees. Settling himself into a thickly padded contour seat, Dallas considered how to proceed. Ash took the seat opposite the mind bank, manipulated controls with more speed and ease than a man just out of hypersleep ought to have. The science officer's ability to handle machines was unmatched. It was a special rapport Dallas often wished he possessed. Still groggy from the after effects of hypersleep, he punched out a primary request. Distortion patterns chased each other across the screen, settled down to form recognizable words. Dallas checked his wording, found it standard. "Alert over-monitoring function for matrix display and inquiry." The ship found it acceptable also, and Mother's reply was immediate. "Over-monitoring address matrix." Columns of informational categorizations lined up for inspection beneath this terse legend. Dallas examined the long list of fine print, located the section he wanted, typed in, "Command priority alert." "Over-monitor function ready for inquiry," Mother responded. Computer minds were not programmed for verbosity. Mother was no exception to the rule. Which was fine with Dallas. He wasn't in a talkative mood. He typed briefly, "What's the story, Mother?" and waited. You couldn't say that the bridge of the Nostromo was spacious. Rather, it was somewhat less claustrophobic than the ship's other rooms and chambers, but not by much. Five contour seats awaited their respective occupants. Lights flashed patiently on and off at multiple consoles, while numerous screens of varying shapes and sizes also awaited the arrival of humans who were prepared to tell them what to display. A large bridge would have been an expensive frivolity, since the crew spent most of its flight time motionless in the freezers. It was designed strictly for work, not for relaxation or entertainment. The people who worked there knew this as thoroughly as did the machines. A sealed door slid silently into a wall. Kane entered, followed closely by Ripley, Lambert, and Ash. They made their way to their respective stations, settled behind consoles with the ease and familiarity of old friends greeting one another after a long time apart. A fifth seat remained empty, would continue unoccupied, until Dallas returned from his tete-a-tete with Mother. Nostromo's Mind Bank computer, the nickname was an accurate one, not given in jest. People grow very serious when speaking about the machinery responsible for keeping them alive. For its part, the machine accepted the designation with equal solemnity, if not the emotional overtones. Their clothing was as relaxed as their bodies, casual travesties of crew member uniforms. Each reflected the personality of the wearer. Shirts and slacks, all were rumpled and worn after years of storage. So were the bodies they encased. The first sound spoken on the bridge in many years summed up the feelings of all present, even though they couldn't understand them. Jones was meowing when Ripley sent him on the deck. He changed that to a purr, sliding sensuously around her ankles as she snuggled herself into the high back seat. Plug us in. Kane was checking out his own console, caressing the automatics with his eyes, hunting for contrasts and uncertainties, as Ripley and Lambert commenced throwing necessary switches and thumbing requisite controls. There was a flurry of visual excitement as new lights and colors migrated across readout panels and screens. It gave the feeling that the instruments were pleased by the reappearance of their organic counterparts and were anxious to display their talents at first opportunity. Fresh numbers and words appeared on readouts in front of him. Kane correlated them with well-remembered ones imprinted in his mind. Looks okay so far. Give us something to stare at. Lambert's fingers danced an arpeggio on a tightly clustered rank of controls. View screens came alive all over the bridge, most suspended from the ceiling for easier inspection. The navigator examined the square eyes closest to her seat, frowned immediately. Much that she saw was expected. Too much was not. The most important thing, the anticipated shape that should be dominating their vision, was absent. So important was it that it negated the normality of everything else. Where's Earth? Examining his own screen carefully, Kane discerned blackness speckled with stars and little else. Granting the possibility that they'd emerged from hyperspace too soon, the home system at least should be clear in the screen. But Sol was as invisible as the expected Earth. You're the navigator. Lambert, you tell me. There was a central sun fixed squarely in the middle of the multiple screens, but it wasn't Sol. The color was wrong, and computer-enhanced dots orbiting it were worse than wrong. They were impossible, improper of shape, of size, of number. That's not our system, Ripley observed, numbly, giving voice to the obvious. Maybe the trouble's just our orientation, not that of the stars. Kane didn't sound very convincing, even to himself. Ships have been known to come out of hyperspace, ask backward to their intended destinations. That could be Centauri, at top amplification. Sol might be behind us. Let's take a scan before we do any panicking. He did not add that the system visible on the screens resembled that of Centauri about as much as it did that of Sol. Sealed cameras on the battered skin of the Nostromo began to move silently in the vacuum of space, hunting through infinity for hints of a warm Earth. Secondary cameras on the Nostromo's cargo and a monstrous aggregation of bulky forms and metal shapes contributed their own line of sight. Inhabitants of an earlier age would have been astonished to learn that the Nostromo was towing a considerable quantity of crude oil through the void between the stars, encased in its own automatic, steadily functioning refinery. That oil would be finished petrochemicals by the time the Nostromo arrived in orbit around Earth. Such methods were necessary. While mankind had long since developed marvelous, efficient substitutes for powering their civilization, they had done so only after greedy individuals had sucked the last drop of petroleum from a drained Earth. Fusion and solar power ran all of man's machines, but they couldn't substitute for petrochemicals. A fusion engine could not produce plastics, for example. The modern worlds could exist without power sooner than they could without plastics. Hence the presence of the Nostromo's commercially viable, if historically incongruous, cargo of machinery and the noisome black liquid it patiently processed. The only system the cameras picked up was the one set neatly in the center of the various screens, the one with the improper necklace of planets circling an off-color star. There was no doubt now in Kane's mind, and less than that in Lambert's, that the Nostromos intended that system to be their immediate destination. Still, it could be an error in time and not in space. Sol could be the system, located in the distance just to his star's left or right. There was a sure way to find out. Contact traffic control. Kane was chewing his lower lip. If we can pick something up, anything from them, we'll know we're in the right quadrant. If Sol's anywhere nearby, we'll receive a reply from one of the out-system relay stations. Lambert's fingers nicked different controls. This is the deep space commercial tug Nostromo. Registration number 180246. En route to Earth with bulk cargo, crude petroleum, and appropriate refinery. Calling Antarctica Traffic Control. Do you read me? Over. Only the faint, steady hiss of distant suns replied over the speakers. Near Ripley's feet, Jones the cat purred in harmony with the stars. Lambert tried again. Deep space commercial tug Nostromo calling Sol Antarctica Traffic Control. We are experiencing navigation fix difficulties. This is a priority call. Please respond. Still, only the nervous stellar zizzle pop. Lambert looked worried. Mayday, Mayday, tug Nostromo calling Sol Traffic Control or any other vessel in listening range. Mayday, respond. The unjustified distress call, Lambert knew they were not in any immediate danger, went unanswered and unchallenged. Discouraged, she shut off the transmitter, but left the receiver on the all channels open in case another broadcasting ship happened to pass close by. I knew we couldn't be near our system, Ripley mumbled. I know the area. She nodded towards the screen hanging above her own station. That's nowhere near Sol, and neither are we. Keep trying, Kane ordered her. He turned back to face Lambert. So then where are we? You got a reading yet? Give me a minute, will you? This ain't easy. We're way out in the boondocks. Keep trying, working on it. Several minutes of intense searching and computer cooperation produced a tight grin of satisfaction on her face. Found it, and us. We're just short of Zeta 2 Reticuli. We haven't even reached the outer populated ring yet. Too deep to grab onto a navigation beacon, let alone a Sol traffic relay. So what the hell are we doing here? Kane wondered aloud. If there's anything wrong with the ship and we're not home, why did Mother defrost us? It was only coincidence and not a direct response to the exec's musing, but an attention to station horn began its loud and imperative beeping. Near the stern of the Nostromo was a vast chamber mostly filled with complex, powerful machinery. The ship's heart lived there. The extensive propulsion system that enabled the vessel to distort space, ignore time, and thumb its metallic nose at Einstein, and only incidentally power the devices that kept her fragile human crew alive. At the fore end of this massive, humming complex was a glass cubicle, a transparent pimple on the tip of a hyperdrive iceberg. Within, settled in contour seats, rested two men. They were responsible for the health and well-being of the ship's drive, a situation both were content with. They took care of it, and it took care of them. Most of the time, it took perfectly good care of itself, which enabled them to spend their time on more enlightening, worthwhile projects such as drinking beer and swapping dirty stories. At the moment, it was Parker's turn to ramble. He was reciting for the 100th time the tale of the engineering apprentice and the free fall cat house. It was a good story, one that never failed to elicit a knowing snigger or two from the silent Brett, a belly laugh from the storyteller himself. And so the madam busts in on me, all worried and mad at the same time, the engineer was saying, and insists we come and rescue this poor sap. Guess he didn't know what he was getting into. As usual, he roared at the pun. You remember that place? Four walls, floor and ceiling perfectly mirrored, no bed, just a velvet net suspended in the center of the room to confine your activities and keep you from bouncing off the walls in zero-G? He shook his head in disapproving remembrance. That's no place for amateurs to fool around. No, sir. Guess this kid got embarrassed or cajoled into trying it by his crewmates. And what the girl involved told me later, as she was cleaning herself up, they got started off fine, but then they started to spin, and he panicked, couldn't stop their tumbling. She tried, but it takes two to stop as well as start in a free fall. What with all the mirrors messing up his sense of position and all, plus the free tumbling, he couldn't stop throwing up. Parker downed another mouthful of beer. Never saw such a mess in your natural life. Bet they're still working in those mirrors. Yeah, Rhett smiled appreciatively. Parker sat still, letting the last vestiges of the memory fade from his mind. They left a pleasantly lascivious residue behind. Absently, he flipped a key switch over his console. A gratifyingly green light appeared above it, held steady. "How's your light?" "Green," admitted Brett, after repeating the switch-and-check procedure with his own instrumentation. "Mine, too." Parker studied the bubbles within the beer. Several hours out of the hypersleep, and he was bored already. The engine room ran itself with quiet efficiency, wasted no time making him feel extraneous.